Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried, and history sometimes moves fast, comrades and friends. It really does. I mean, in the past week, we've seen how much things have escalated in the Middle East, in West Asia, in Palestine. We've seen the apartheid regime of Israel make two high-profile assassinations, striking Beirut in Lebanon and killing Fouad Shukr of Hezbollah, of the resistance movement. And we saw the chief negotiator of Hamas, also of the resistance, Ismail Haniyeh, was assassinated in Tehran, Iran, while he was there to attend the inauguration of the new Iranian president. Just brazen assassinations. Ismail Haniyeh was the chief negotiator, engaged in peace talks with the Israelis, and they killed him. I mean, it shows you what the apartheid regime thinks of those peace talks. It doesn't want peace. It doesn't want peace talks. It doesn't want anything like that. It wants escalation. It wants regional war. It wants war with Iran. It wants war with Lebanon. It wants war across the region. It wants to bring the United States into it, which is the only way I'm sure it believes that it can win at this point against the resistance. And it wants to set the whole area on fire and kill however many tens of thousands of people. That's what it wants to do. And of course, the resistance will respond. You know, there will be retaliation, justifiable retaliation. You know, this cannot go unanswered. But nonetheless, yeah, this is a very difficult time, difficult situation. You have a, you know, just out of control genocidal regime that is seeking carnage on a mass scale. So I'm going to talk about that a little later in the program. Right now, I want to talk about what's going on in Venezuela. I haven't talked about Venezuela in quite a while on this show, talking about, you know, the Bolivarian Revolution, the Bolivarian process initiated by Hugo Chavez back in 1998, when he won the election back then and basically brought in a socialist, or at least a socialist-leaning government in Venezuela, which the United States has been trying again and again to overthrow ever since. You know, whether that's the coup in 2002 or just crying foul every time there's an election result that they don't like, which they just did just this past week, predictably. And also like invoking like just street violence, you know, just brutal violence in the streets, you know, hiring thugs, burning down buildings, attacking hospitals, attacking polling centers, attacking government buildings, attacking, you know, any sort of public infrastructure they have, burning their own country down, basically. I mean, this is the U.S.-backed opposition. You know, they're more aligned, frankly, with the United States, with the empire, than they are with their own country. You know, they're traitors in the clearest sense, and, you know, they make no bones about it. I mean, you have the opposition leader, Corina Machado, who was actually barred from running. They actually had to run this Gonzalez character, this 80-year-old guy, in her place because she was not allowed to run because the Supreme Court found her guilty of fraud and various other crimes. But she was behind the scenes the whole time with the American-backed opposition in Venezuela, just directing things, being the backseat driver. And of course, the backseat driver for her is probably the CIA and the U.S. State Department. Definitely the U.S. State Department. And she openly called for like American military intervention in her own country, right? This is pretty much like the Syrian opposition back during the Syrian civil war was constantly calling for American boots on the ground inside their own country. I mean, how patriotic is that, right? You want a foreign military to come in and basically put you in power, you know, over, and you don't care how many of your own people die in the process. Like, what is that? But that's the Venezuelan opposition. Now they got this Gonzalez guy who apparently got like, I don't know, 42-44% of the vote or something like that. And the U.S. just proclaimed him that they're going to recognize him as the elected president of Venezuela. You know, just this is the same as what they did with Juan Guaido, you know, back in 2018, 2019. You know, just this nobody, you know. I mean, Juan Guaido didn't even run in a presidential election like ever in his life. And yet they tried to anoint him back then as the president of Venezuela, you know, and by all indications, this was a free and fair election. And it's been checked, double checked. I think there were like about 1,000 foreign observers who were there, you know, Nicolas Maduro, who like, you know, basically won 52% of the vote, managed to win with that. You know, he's gone to the Venezuelan Supreme Court. He's submitting everything. He's submitting all the details. He's going through this whole process. You know, being immensely transparent. And, of course, the opposition doesn't care. They want violence. They want to burn the things down. They want to, like, trash the place. They want to tear down statues of Hugo Chavez. They want to just wreck shop because, ultimately, they're pawns of the United States, just as, like, Maduro basically has been saying. You know, they don't love their country. You know, and I just want to quote a Twitter X post by Danny Haifong here. And I think this is pretty, this just spells it out in very clear language. Nicolas Maduro is the president of Venezuela, period. Venezuela has one of the most democratic electoral systems in the world. The U.S. has overthrown more democracies than years I've been alive. Washington has no right to determine the destiny of Venezuelans. Straight up. Straight up. So, obviously, there's a lot of propaganda about this kind of stuff. And just to break through that, well, I want to play a clip from Breakthrough News. Kay Pritzker did a really good job this past week just breaking down, breaking through all the propaganda and really talking about what's really going on in Venezuela. So he did it very briefly, and I'm just going to play that clip for you right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The media is lying to you about Venezuela. By now, you've probably seen the videos of people in Venezuela protesting, tearing down statues, burning banners of the current president, and blocking Venezuela's main airport. They're protesting because Venezuela just had an election, and the country's electoral authority announced that Nicolas Maduro, the candidate of the United Socialist Party, beat the right-wing opposition candidate, Edmundo González. For months, the opposition said they'd only respect the election results if they won. And sure enough, they immediately said the election was fraudulent after they lost. So what's their evidence? The first thing they say is that they've collected 73% of the voting precinct's paper results, and that the paper results don't match the electronic results. For those who don't know, Venezuela's voting system was designed with multiple controls to prevent fraud. There's a two-step voting process, first where the voter has to produce his or her national ID card and scan their fingerprint to cast an electronic vote, and then the second part, the paper ballot, where the voter receives a paper receipt of their vote, which they drop into a ballot box, creating two tallies which can be checked against one another, one electronic and one paper. The opposing candidates each have witnesses in the precincts for the counting of the paper ballots to check against the electronic tally that gets released by the electoral authority. There were also over 900 election observers from 95 different countries present, and if you look at the reports from Sunday, people were overwhelmingly reporting a calm, orderly process at the voting stations. The opposition is claiming that they already have 3/4 of the paper ballots collected, but they haven't actually produced any of them. So until that happens, it's just talk. Another talking point the media has been running with is this exit poll that allegedly shows Edmundo González winning by over 30%. The poll has been cited by the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Reuters, and seemingly shows that the results being reported don't match what voters were saying as they were leaving the polls. The only problem with this? The polling firm they're citing is basically an arm of the US government. As research done by Ben Norton over at the Geopolitical Economy Report shows, the polling firm Edison Research counts among its top clients Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and the Middle East Broadcasting Networks, all of which are U.S. state-owned media that were created to disseminate pro-U.S. messaging in their respective regions. They all work under the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which is a U.S. government agency, and its website says that the media outlets serve, quote, the long-range interests of the United States. Exit polling is also illegal in Venezuela, so they did this outside the law with no way of cross-checking it. U.S. policy towards Venezuela has been incredibly hostile for the last 20 years, so it's hard to believe that a polling firm whose whole business model is based on conducting polls for U.S. state media would suddenly turn out a poll completely contradicting the U.S. narrative. But by far the most telling aspect of all of this is that the Venezuelan opposition said they weren't going to recognize the election results way before the election even started. In a video interview with the Financial Times a month before the election, opposition leader Maria Corina Machado said that they expected to win by a landslide, but that if they didn't, it could only be because Maduro committed fraud. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. Venezuela's electoral authority is supposed to have 72 hours to release the full results, but the opposition decided within 1 hour to declare it illegitimate, and within 12 hours they were staging an insurrection. The US did the same thing too. Almost immediately after votes started being tallied, Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, immediately tried to cast doubt on the election results. This begs the question, how could US officials have known their position on the election before it was even finished? And the answer is, they already had their minds made up. They were going to declare the election fraudulent no matter what. In fact, if the US respected the outcome of this election, it would be the exception to the rule. In 2019, a Venezuelan politician named Juan Guaido claimed he should be the real president of Venezuela after Nicolas Maduro won the election in 2018. Guaido was basically unknown in Venezuelan politics prior to his declaration and wasn't even a candidate in the 2018 election. And yet, despite this, the Trump administration pushed this ridiculous idea that he was actually the president of Venezuela. The US not only met with Guaido like he was the president, they also handed him state assets like Citgo and the Venezuelan embassy, while they funded extreme right-wing opposition groups in Venezuela and openly called for the overthrow of the elected government. In 2002, the Bush administration backed a coup against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who had begun redistributing oil revenue from Venezuela's state-owned oil company from the rich to the poor. U.S. leaders met with the coup plotters, who were handpicked stooges of the Venezuelan elite, and openly endorsed the coup during the brief couple days when the coup mongers had taken power. There's a great documentary about the 2002 coup called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which you should all watch. This all begs another question. Why does the U.S. want to overthrow the Venezuelan government? And the simple answer is, Venezuela has the largest petroleum reserves in the world. For the longest time, Venezuela's oil was there for the rich to plunder. The Venezuelan elite and multinational corporations treated Venezuela's oil sector like a personal piggy bank, while the Venezuelan people lived in absolute poverty. This went on until Hugo Chavez, a socialist, won the 1998 election and decided that Venezuela's wealth should be enjoyed by the Venezuelan people, not the elite or foreign corporations. Both the 2002 coup attempt and the 2019 coup attempt were directly tied to oil. In fact, in one interview during the 2019 coup attempt, Donald Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, openly stated that he wanted to see U.S. oil companies take over Venezuela's energy sector.
So if you think of a company like Citgo, which is owned by PDVSA, which is the state-run oil company there in Venezuela, we have a lot of those Citgo assets right here in the U.S. Is that something, for example, sir, that you're looking at?
Yeah, well, we're in conversation with major American companies now that are either in Venezuela or, in the case of Citgo, here in the United States. It'll make a big difference to the United States economically if we could have American oil companies really invest in and produce the oil capabilities in Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of the United States.
But Hugo Chavez wasn't just a resource nationalist. He was also an anti-imperialist. Part of what he did to change Venezuela was that he decided that Venezuela would no longer be a cog in the U.S.'s imperialist fever dreams in Latin America, that it would advocate for a new international order based on peace and cooperation instead of invasions and economic exploitation. Venezuela became one of the first countries to oppose the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and also became an unwavering supporter of the Palestinian cause. Nicolas Maduro, Chavez's successor, has continued this legacy, forging closer ties with Global South countries seeking a new international system, one that's not based on U.S. domination. Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution has inspired other progressive movements throughout Latin America that have undermined U.S. power in the region. Antony Blinken, Marco Rubio, and all the other war criminals that have been managing and overseeing the genocide in Palestine didn't suddenly wake up one day and realize that they care so deeply about the little boys and girls in Venezuela. In fact, the U.S. government is currently enforcing a sanctions regime that's estimated to have killed at least 100,000 people in Venezuela through manufactured poverty and scarcity. U.S. sanctions against Venezuela's oil sector, which is its primary source of income, caused the oil sector to collapse and the subsequent decrease of government income by 99%. So, yes, the poverty and scarcity you hear about is very real, but it's caused by U.S. sanctions, which have forced Venezuelans to live off 1% of their pre-sanctions income. This is also what's behind the wave of Venezuelan migration that you hear about on the news. It all comes back to this policy of manufactured poverty. If the United States actually cared about the well-being of Venezuelans, they wouldn't be strangling the Venezuelan economy to the point where there are shortages of fuel and medicine. In fact, the United States tends to be the most violent when it feigns humanitarian concern. They manufacture social crises and then use it as an excuse for regime change. The U.S. has a long history of supporting these color revolutions. When they know they can't directly invade a country, they create a social crisis to undermine it. And now, they're doing the same thing to Venezuela. Don't fall for it this time.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. De pie. Cantar que vamos a triunfar, avanzan ya banderas de unidad, y tú vendrás marchando junto a mí, y así verás tu canto y tu bandera florecer, la luz de un rojo amanecer, anuncia ya la vida que vendrá, de pie marchar el pueblo va a
se alzarán, dirán, canción de libertad, con decisión la patria vencerá. Y ahora el pueblo que se alza en la lucha con voz de gigante, gritando adelante, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido. La patria está forjando la unidad, de norte a sur se movilizará, desde el salar ardiente y mineral al bosque austral, unidos en la lucha y el trabajo irán, la patria cubrirán su paso ya, anuncia el porvenir, de pie cantar, el pueblo va a triunfar, millones ya imponen la verdad, de acero son, ardiente batallón, sus manos van llevando la justicia y la razón, mujer, con fuego y con valor, ya estás aquí junto al trabajador. Y ahora el pueblo que se alza en la lucha con voz de gigante, gritando adelante, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
You're listening to Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Kilabayun with El Pueblo Unido. Very appropriate song, very appropriate anthem, given that the Venezuelan people are actually, well, they're out on the streets now, not because the opposition told them to be out on the streets and told them to wreck things, but because they are defending the legitimate, duly elected government, socialist government of Nicolas Maduro. That's why they're out on the streets, and they are defending it. And they're like, they're coming out in masses, tens of thousands, every day over the past week. And that's what's really going on in Venezuela. So I said I was going to get to focus more on what's going on in the in Palestine and in the wider area of West Asia. And Breakthrough News actually had a really good interview with Lebanese journalist Gadi Francis, and I want to play that for you right now because just she knocked it out of the park in terms of the describing what the situation is now, what it means for the resistance, and what it means going forward. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
So we want to, I think, go ahead, Rania, and get right into it. And obviously one of the biggest issues that is facing the globe right now that everyone is talking about is the possibility of a continued escalation by Israel into Lebanon, the possibility that they may invade or do various other things in order to increase the level of violence they are imposing on the people of Lebanon. And we are very, very honored to be joined here on the show as we move forward by Gadi Francis, who's a war correspondent based in Lebanon. Gadi, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Eugene. Such a pleasure to be in the middle between you and Rania.
Well, believe me, it is also our pleasure to have you here with us. And I guess, just to start here, I don't want to have too many projections because you never know exactly what's happening, but it really does feel that Israel, sort of step by step, is laying the basis to keep increasing almost terroristic-like activity on Lebanon. And from your perspective, I mean, I wonder how you are interpreting this in terms of what their goals may be and if you think it's leading to something further or really just trying to save face in the midst of what Hezbollah has been able to do in defense and in relationship to what's happening in Gaza.
Well, first of all, Eugene, when someone crazy is having a tantrum, you don't really look at what are they trying to do. This is a genocidal, ethnic cleansing, apartheid state occupation that has been carrying out a massacre, a televised genocide for the past 9 months. So they're not really very sane when we're looking at the situation here. I'm always feeling better and more secure when the ball is in the hands of the resistance, like it is right now. Because it has been a tit-for-tat exchange for the past 9 months, especially on the Lebanese front. A target for a target, a kill for a kill, a base for a base. And the resistance has been able to play this, to orchestrate this kind of deterrence and retaliation in a way that would always preserve and protect the Lebanese infrastructure. And the complex political situation of Lebanon does not really help in opening a full-blown war as well. So right now, after the assassination of Fuad Shukr, they are waiting for Hezbollah's retaliation. And when the Israelis are waiting for the retaliation, because I trust the wisdom of Hezbollah and their retaliation and their strikes, we feel at ease because we know that they will have it calculated in a way. When you ask me why the Israelis are doing that, are they trying really to collect some wins or to save face? I think yes. I think they're trying, especially Benjamin Netanyahu is trying like tactical wins, which really are not wins if you go... If you go to dissect these events, I mean, Ismail Haniyeh is not the first. He's just another Hamas leader that has been assassinated. His predecessors were all assassinated. When you look at Fuad Shukr and Hezbollah, his colleagues and fellows have been assassinated in the same manner. The leaders of the resistance are made for martyrdom. They calculate this martyrdom, they put it in front of their eyes, their families know it, their lifestyles are always governed in a way where this is a daily a possibility in their lives. So when you look at Fuad Shukr, you say he lived 40 years after the Israelis were trying to kill him. 40 years, every day and night the Israelis were trying to kill this man that was able to... expand the warfare technology for the resistance, to expand missiles and ways in fighting the Israelis for years and years. He was there in every fight. He's been in the leadership of the Al-Aqsa flood operations and also the operations before. So this is not really a win for Israel. These people are martyrs in the waiting. It's actually putting the ball once again in the hands or in the control of the resistance axis. They can choose how, when, and what kind of retaliation to carry on. And I think the coming days will show the world how wise, when you say non-state actors and some of the media calls them militias, and you look at how wise and how much they are caring for the civilian life and the civilian cost and the way they are governing the retaliatory strikes. I mean, these non-state actors that are called militias and are called the resistance axis in this part of the world have really proven to be more respectable. They respect the international law, although they are occupied and they have every right to do everything they want. But they play more reasonably and more wisely and strongly and faithfully than the colonizing occupation apartheid regime.
Ghadi, I'm sure you saw that Hassan Nasrallah spoke today, and he made a point that you just touched on about the fact that the Israelis continue to assassinate resistance leaders and it doesn't change anything. In fact, it makes these organizations more powerful. And he also made the point, he said that we have entered a new stage of this war, where before a lot of these fronts, whether Lebanon or Yemen or Iraq, were supportive fronts for Gaza. But now he called them battle fronts in their own right, because the Israelis are directly crossing red lines. They've been targeting Lebanon. They actually targeted Yemen. They bombed Yemen last week, I believe it was. And we're now at a new dangerous phase. I'm just curious, you know, as somebody, you've been to Iraq, you've covered Yemen, you've been to Yemen, you've been to the tunnels of Gaza, you have obviously been all across Lebanon, you've been all across Syria. When we watch this battle that's played out from October till now, do you see this as a new phase in this war? And I'm talking here about beyond Palestine.
Well, And also Iran. I've been to Iran. Being all in all these countries, I think from the beginning, regardless of the nomenclature or the designation of the war, the Israelis and the Americans regard all these entities as one. And they impose sanctions, they demonize them, they character assassinate their politicians and their leaders, and they pay billions of dollars to fight them every time there is any kind of elections, whether it's presidential or parliamentary. I'm talking about Iraq, Lebanon, and all these countries. So I think the new era that Sayyid Nasrallah has announced, when these are all battlefields, it has been like that, but it hasn't been really declared as such in the past. And probably it's also because of the wisdom of the resistance axis and how they're playing out this war. But now the Israelis and the Americans, they have called them battlefields. They have touched the beasts, you know. And this is why, in terms of the historical events and days that we are living, we are witnessing the end of Israel. I mean, whether you see that or not, in the future, our grandkids will look at these times as the last days of Israel, because you cannot carry on a massacre and televise it and post it on TikTok and get away with it. It's not going to happen. We will always know that one of the main reasons why Israel is ending is that all of the Levant, all of Suraqia, all of Greater Syria, all the people have been antagonized and killed enough and slaughtered enough to gain one faith in fighting this oppression. I really think we are going to witness a new season of this war, but I don't think it's going to be a full-blown operation, not in Lebanon, not in Iraq, not in any of them. And by the way, Rania, you've been covering this region for the past few years as well. And, you know, just like I know, if it's assassinations, it hadn't stopped before. They assassinated people before October 7. I mean, leaders and so on, whether it's Iranians, Lebanese, Palestinians in Syria and Lebanon and Iran. Okay, in Iraq as well, the Americans have been doing this on and off for the past decade or more. Syria as well. So when they talk about an escalation, I mean, there wasn't peace here. It's just your way of covering it was different. Do we really forget what they did in Iraq? Do you really forget who they assassinated in Baghdad International Airport? There was no October 7, but they did something very similar to what they did to Ismail Haniyeh. I mean, in terms of the politics and the policy. This war has been going on in this region for 76 years plus. The ways and the shapes and the manifestations of the war differ and alter with the times. But this only makes us feel more comfortable and more optimistic about the future, because it's the wish. It has been a wish for the Palestinians to see the Iraqis and the Syrians and the Lebanese and the Yemenis involved in their struggle. Had that been the case since 1948, Palestine would have been liberated a long time ago.
You know, I think one of the factors that is important, I think, especially for people watching in the United States about how this is portrayed, especially sort of the various resistance fronts, is, and you know, because you read the American media, it's like Lebanon has been hijacked by Hezbollah, Gaza has been hijacked by Hamas, and all the people really would reject these organizations if they weren't, you know, funded by the evil Iranian, you know, terrorist regime. So I was hoping you could also talk a little bit about that aspect, is, you know, how the people of Lebanon and in these other places feel about the resistance forces, because, you know, maybe it seems obvious to some people, but it's obviously going to be impossible to sustain yourself if you don't have popular support.
I think it is time for the American media and the American politicians to stop saying lies and believing them, because even the American people do not believe them anymore. I mean, you can say this lie, you can say the same lie a million years, it's not going to change. Hezbollah is a part of the parliament. How could they hijack if they have the most voted parliamentary members ever in the history of Lebanon? 50,000 plus Mohammad Raad got. They have their supporters are Lebanese, their fighters and their martyrs are Lebanese. You cannot call white, black, or blue, green, and just believe it. And it's very obvious that Hezbollah is a part of the Lebanese social structure. It is very obvious that it is part of the political structure. And if they do not acknowledge the reality and they always think of them as aliens who hijack, they will never be able to fight them. They will never be able to change the policies or to make them less loved among their people. If you do not really know your enemy very well, you will never be able to fight them. One of their biggest failures, when I'm speaking about the anti-Hezbollah states and actors and people and politicians, one of their biggest failures comes from them denying the facts. They don't want to see the fact. Whether you say, I mean, even the Israelis, one of their ministers was on TV saying, oh, they have Katyusha. I mean, Rania made me listen to that lunatic on the dispatches earlier. And he's saying, oh, they have Katyushas, what can they do? He can say we only have Katyushas all day, all night. But the missiles are getting there. Their headquarters are being evacuated. Our drone footage is getting out there in the whole wide world. So the lies do not work anymore. Hezbollah is a part of the Lebanese structure. And before Hezbollah was born, there was another resistance, armed resistance group that was a part of the Lebanese structure. The action here that started all of these non-state actors is, and they were all legalized by their people and loved and revered by their people because they emerged as their protectors. They were protecting them from the ongoing slaughter that has started with the Haganah 1948 and haven't stopped with the neo-Haganahs and the neo-Nazis in 2024. We are seeing what they are doing. So this has been ongoing for all this period of time. The people in Lebanon, the people in Palestine, any oppressed or occupied people would revere their resistance groups as protectors. Right now, even the people who are against Hezbollah. Right now, if Beirut is under attack and Hezbollah is actually fighting back and protecting Lebanon, every single Lebanese person will be praying for them because our well-being is part of their well-being as well. So American media and mainstream media and politicians keep telling you these things, keep telling you that all Islam are terrorists and these are Islamic group. But I mean, you are more aware than that. You have seen how they treat Islamophobics who killed children in the American community. I think the terrorism, the real terrorism today, is the bias and is the absence of accountability towards these crimes that are happening. Some of them we're not even knowing about. So the era of listening to what the American mainstream media is saying, I think it's done. I think all the world, nobody believes them anymore. Not even the American people and the American youth, as we could see from the college encampments. I mean, I think the truth is out there and they cannot really serve in denying facts anymore.
Yeah, it's really incredible. There's just one last thing I wanted to touch on, Ghadi, before we let you go here, and that's the fact, speaking of lies, I noticed that after, you know, I wasn't in Lebanon when the killings of those children on the soccer field in the occupied Golan Heights took place, and Hezbollah vehemently denied that they were involved in it. The Israelis, of course, blamed Hezbollah. Hezbollah said this was like an errant Iron Dome missile. I'm just curious, what was the sentiment in Lebanon about that in terms of how the media covered it and how people were viewing it? Did anybody buy Israel's side of the story, or was everybody just pretty certain it was likely the Israelis?
I will tell you, it took us split seconds, me and our friend, when we read the news. We looked at each other, and Hezbollah doesn't kill civilians. It took split second. We look at each other, say, we all know Hezbollah doesn't kill civilians. But then the coming minute, we all know that Golan is Syrian. We all know that the Israelis hate Arabs, even the Israeli Arabs. I mean, there's no way that any sane mind could believe that lie. And they want to retaliate for Durzi kids. They really like them so much. Then why did they deny them any papers? Today, does anyone know how's the livelihood of the people in Majd al-Shams in occupied Golan Heights? Does anybody know before they go and carry the Israeli claim? These are not Israeli kids. These are Syrian people who denied Israeli papers, who are paying for it right now. They are lost and stranded in the middle of nowhere. Left, there's Syrian government that cannot access them very well. And there's the occupation. And even if you really had some question and you don't want to believe all of that, you can look at what the people did when Benjamin Netanyahu tried to visit them and tried to pay condolences. They spoke. You know, they kicked him out.
They did indeed, and also Basil Smotrich, so it does say a lot. And certainly, we really appreciate the opportunity, Gadi, for you to join us here and help us sort through all of this. I know you're very busy, so thank you for giving us some of your time here in the Freedom Side.
Thank you for having me, guys.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine. While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we are automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. 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 Palestine remains in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war, we shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if you're Marks and Spencer. And when you're sipping Coca-Cola, that's another pistol in the holster of them soulless soldiers. You say you know about the Zionist lobby, but you put money in their pocket when you're buying their coffee. Talking about revolution sitting in Starbucks. The fact is, that's the type of thinking I can't trust, let alone even start to respect. Before you talk, learn the meaning of that scarf on your neck. Forget Nestle, Obama promised Israel 30 billion over the next decade. They're trigger happy and they're crazy. Think about that when you're putting Huggies nappies on your baby. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. 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 This is not just a war over stolen land. Why do you think little boys are throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on innocent girls while they sleep in their bed. Don't get offended by facts, just try and listen. Nothing is more anti-Semitic than Zionism. So please don't bring bad vibes when you speak to me. There's plenty of rabbis that agree with me. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get it confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more children have to be annihilated? Israel is a terror state, they're terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televised, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. 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 This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I'm Siegfried. And that was Gadi Francis talking to Breakthrough News. And we also had Low Key with Long Live Palestine. Now, yeah, I mean, Gadi Francis said a lot there, you know, in terms of this is basically the end game for Israel. Like, Israel really has no place to go after this. They're backed against the wall by the resistance, and fundamentally it's like a beast lashing out in its death throes in many ways, and desperately trying to get the United States involved in this regional war because they know that's pretty much the only option for them. And to get the Americans to go over there and spill their own blood and all this sort of stuff for their sake, you know. And of course, it's crazy because, you know, like I've seen a lot of commentary in recent days how basically the Israeli government has just thumbed its nose at the, you know, very, like I would say, half-assed American attempts at brokering a ceasefire in the Middle East, you know. They basically thumb their nose at them. Benjamin Netanyahu goes to the, goes to the U.S. Congress and gets like whatever it was, 53 standing ovations or something crazy like that, you know, and just basically acts like he owns the place. I mean, because more or less he has more support in that Congress than probably the president of the United States does right now, you know, and it's like, I mean, we don't even know who's frankly in charge in the United States right now. It's just like, it's very, there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of craziness, and Netanyahu knows how to exploit that, you know. And all his backers, he has all his supporters, you know, like apparently in response to this retaliation from Iran, you know, there's all kinds of American naval assets and military forces that are now converging on Israel basically to try to defend it against this incoming missile strike or drone strike or whatever form it takes. I mean, just like it happened back in April, the last time this kind of thing took place. Yeah, I mean, it's just Israel more or less can do whatever it wants, and the U.S. tails it, the U.S. backs it, and that's the situation right now. You know, so all this talk of like ceasefires, and then, you know, they just killed the main Palestinian negotiator right there in Tehran. You know, Israel assassinating him and stuff. And does the U.S. condemn that? Did they condemn what Israel did, like, for basically scuppering the peace negotiations? No. There's some mild behind-the-scenes criticism from what I hear, like in a phone call or something like that, that, you know, Netanyahu can just brush off easily. And then, yeah, they're moving all their hardware into support Israel. You know, ships, planes, all that kind of stuff. Surface-to-air missile defense systems, all that stuff. You know, they're bringing it all in. And it's just, yeah. Like, just talk about, you know, just blowing out all that talk of negotiated settlement right out of the water. Right? And then you wonder, was it ever serious? And, well, I mean, obviously you have, like Joe Biden and those guys, like, wanting, you know, very spooked that all these Muslim Americans are now abandoning them, abandoning the Democratic Party because they see it's a party of genocide. And yeah, like, they're spooked by that, so they want to talk about ceasefire. They want to do all these, like, really flimsy, stupid PR stunts, like the Gaza Pier, which didn't bring in any humanitarian aid into the besieged Gaza Strip at all, and ultimately floated away. You know, they perform these little PR stunts that they hope is going to win back the Muslim vote in the United States, which of course it won't do. It's incredibly condescending, and I would say actually racist the way they've handled it. You know, in terms of like these little stunts, which they think are going to bring people back, and they can continue supporting genocide all the while. You know, it's absolutely madness. You know, it's absolute madness. But yeah, we're just gonna have to see what comes of this going forward. And the resistance will continue to resist. They will fight against apartheid. They will fight against the United States if they intervene. You know, I mean, there's already resistance going on in Iraq where, you know, they're striking U.S. bases in Iraq, which are there illegally. The Iraqis have told them repeatedly they need to leave, and they've constantly said no. So, yeah, this is what's going on. And of course, I'll continue reporting on it here on Back in the USSR. Just like I'm in Venezuela too. Continue reporting on that. I mean, one of the things I wanted to bring in, I didn't end up having time, but there's major protests going on in Nigeria right now against an extremely corrupt pro-American, basically puppet regime, which is in power there. And increasingly the Nigerian people, I believe one of the things that triggered this latest round of protests is the Nigerian president wanted to buy yet another private jet to fly him around. And he's already got the biggest fleet of private jets of any head of state in Africa. And the people who are like getting fed up, you know, they're facing like economic crisis. They're facing lack decline in living standards. You know, 2/3 of the country lives in poverty. Like they're fed up. They're going to resist. You know, just like and who knows, maybe something similar to what happened in neighboring Niger and Mali and Burkina Faso is going to happen. There's going to be a toppling of that government, and ultimately an anti-imperialist government's going to come in and kick out the Americans and the French or whoever, whatever forces are there, and chart their own independent course. So maybe I'll talk more about that. I'll probably talk more about that next week. But anyways, right now I'm going to say goodnight, comrades and friends, and solidarity. Hang in there. And I will see you all soon. When the generator